I think Merlin's going to be a tough act to follow, but I'll do my best. I know we've got 20 minutes, so I'm going to put a little timer on and try and get the schedule going. Good, right. First, I'd like to thank UTEP, MoMA, for organising the event. I think I'd like to join with all the other speakers that have mentioned not only how welcome it is, but how well organised it's been. And I think everybody's been made to feel very comfortable, and it's been a very exciting event. I'm going to be talking today about the theme of the Caribbean and modernism, and those are things that are kind of I'm very interested in and I participate in. And I'm going to structure the talk very simply in the 20 minutes that we have into some kind of areas or themes or ideas. One is a little kind of pocket modern history of Port of Spain, capital of Trinidad. The other is the thinking that has formed the production of modern architecture in Trinidad and to a lesser or larger extent in other places in the Caribbean. I'm going to talk about the work of two architects, amongst many architects in Trinidad who've made significant contributions, but these two I've had a particular interest in, and I've researched and also have the good fortune of having spent time working with both of them at various stages of my career, Colin Laird and Anthony Lewis, who formed the subject of the essay that I wrote in the Docomomo journal that appeared a couple of years ago, that Gustavo Moret was a co-editor of, which there have been a number of contributors of which are here. And then I'm also going to show you a little bit of some work that I'm working on and try and demonstrate to you the ways in which I try and pursue some of these ideas in the work that I do. But that's not the theme of the talk. I'm just putting those in because I'm always interested in seeing what other people are doing, and it's not often that we get a chance to do it regionally, so I think it's nice to exchange. I've called the talk that I'm going to give critical practice because I think the idea of critical practice is a means of differentiating between what might be called mainstream conventional practice, practice that lacks kind of critical or analytical appraisal as to where it is or what its resonance is. And certainly the architects whose work that I enjoy generally are architects who are reflective about their work, who are conscious of the work that they produce not simply as a means of making money or keeping an office running, but as cultural production, as part of the continuing manufacturing and production of culture alongside literature, alongside music, and alongside all other forms of art. It's also a way of engaging in a broader discourse, you know, by criticizing, by analyzing one's work, and by engaging in conversation with others. I think that we're able to advance what we do and the way that we do it. Elombe, who I had met I think about 2 years ago in Barbados in a meeting that I had with Vicky, who's here today, raised some interesting points yesterday when he kind of, I think, expressed a commonly felt frustration that came about from the student, whose name I've forgotten, I'm afraid, who raised the issue and said, well, what's Caribbean architecture? And Elombe started talking about not being able to see expressions of architecture that somehow resonate in the way that the music of the region does, or in the way that many of the other cultural facets of the region do. And I think that's a very interesting point. I think one of the reasons why we don't see it, or it's not as evident as we might think it to be, is because we're not accustomed to looking at it. It's also not presented, architecture is not presented in a coherent way, in the way that music and other forms of art are as immediate. But, you know, when the students stood up and said, well, what is Caribbean architecture? You know, I mean, I felt inside a kind of response that I often feel when that question's come up, which is that you are in it, you know. I think we're in a very fine piece of Caribbean architecture. But maybe the issue or the question is not what is it, but it's simply to pursue it and to practice it and to evolve discourse around it, rather than attempting to specifically define it or give it some sort of prescriptive measure. And all of this reminds me of a very important quote that Kenneth Frampton used in a seminal essay from the mid-80s. It's an essay that he's continued to write really many times towards a critical regionalism. He quoted from Paul Ricoeur, and I think it's a very interesting quote, and I'd like to start my brief talk with it, because I think it's something that relates to us still, whether one pursues a regionalist argument or not. And the quote goes, "Thus we come to the crucial problem confronting nations just rising from underdevelopment. In order to get on the road toward modernization, is it necessary to jettison the old cultural past, which has been the raison d'etre of a nation? And therein lies the paradox. On the one hand, the new culture has to root itself in the soil of the past, forge a national spirit, and yet it has to unfurl the spiritual and cultural revindication before the colonialist personality. And I think implicit in that is a lot of the kind of dilemma that architects face, is how do you make something new, how do you make something that's true, and but yet also adopt modern advancement and modernization? And I think that's the kind of key question that always recurs at these conferences and these exchanges and within this discourse. And I think it's a central idea. And in the case of Trinidad, I think recurs paradox. I think it's compounded because there's really an absence of what you could call any indigenous authentic cultural past. And I know that might seem like a controversial statement, right? But I mean that Trinidad, for example, had a large part of its population wiped out by Spanish colonizers. And the population was made up from immigration. So how does one define or determine what's indigenous in that context? I think that's an important issue. It sets an interesting challenge because it then compels us to look perhaps deeper and in a more broad way for sources or influences or impulses. And I think that's when it becomes interesting, because very clearly that tends to be a very kind of single directional activity that revolves at the moment through magazines and the internet and looks to North America or Europe or Japan. And I think the questions and the issues that have been raised are really about looking within the region, which is what we're doing here today. And I think what has been happening over the last couple of years are the sort of regional and cultural events that organizations like the FCAA and other useful organizations have been developing. I'm going to give you a little look, for those of you that don't know where Trinidad is. We're right at the end of the chain of the archipelago there. So we're a good little way from Jamaica and just off the coast of South America. You can see Venezuela from Trinidad, from Port of Spain, up from up the hills. It's very, very close. It's not a densely populated part of Venezuela, but you can see it. Modern history, I think that the history of Trinidad, whilst we look back and the history of a lot of the Caribbean, is really essentially a modern history. It's coincident with a lot of activities that were happening in the world that led to what we now understand coherently as modernization or modernism. It's a drawing from a plantation, boiling sugar, and it's an example of sort of an industrial technique being applied to a landscape in a remote place. You know, I think it's a very modern thrust or trajectory that these societies and the landscape has evolved from. That's Port of Spain, so the view looking southeast across the city to the central plains of Trinidad. We've got some very beautiful landscapes. This is in Carony, it's a mangrove landscape that's largely preserved, although increasingly threatened. And this is an image I found in a book, the author of which I've often tried to track down is a Venezuelan architect, and he published this book. It was published by Princeton University Press when I was a student in London, and I was fascinated by it. And he took a lot of pictures of some islands off the north coast of Venezuela, Los Roques, and what was compelling about this image was the similarity it had to this image, which is an evocation by Casaubon, a Trinidadian painter from the 19th century. And it really kind of gave me a clear idea of what Port of Spain, the scale of Port of Spain, would have been like when it began as a little trading port. These are some images of downtown Port of Spain, what was then called Marine Square, that is now Independence Square. You can see people wandering around in fancy dress and riding horses, so it's, you know, a long time ago. And this is an image also by Casaubon, which shows the reclamation of the waterfront. For those of you who are familiar with Port of Spain, this is South Quay. And this is all the reclamation that was going on, and you can see all these ships and boats kind of coming in, mooring there, and, you know, this is the time when Trinidad is becoming a very active trading port. Some images of Frederick Street, downtown Port of Spain. You can see there are some vehicles there, the same street a few years later on. And then towards the middle part of the 20th century, the Americans came in pursuit of oil and started developing the infrastructure of Trinidad. There was also two very, very large military bases in Trinidad. The largest U.S. military base outside of the United States was in Trinidad during the Second World War. Comprehensively transformed the landscape with the provision of highways, certain types of infrastructure, these beach facilities at Macquarie. This is Salvatore building that was built around this period in downtown Port of Spain, a huge edifice. It's subsequently been knocked down, but it was a sort of example of the sort of bold gestures that were taking place. Another building in Independence Square. And you can see that, you know, modernism was sort of taking its roots in the post-war period with the construction of these commercial buildings, and people had a confidence and a desire, in a way, to express modernity and modernization concurrent with the idea of national identity and nationalism. So modernism, for a brief period, became the expression of that nationalism and that identity. John Donaldson Technical Institute, again, another building that's, I understand, likely to be demolished soon to make way for a new development. And then you have the sort of Trinidad family, the sort of new modern family, Caribbean family, you know, where, again, I think the society became very conscious of itself as not something peripheral or satellite, but something central, something with its own identity, the family and the values that were sort of inculcated and brought in from different cultures, or the image of that, and there's an iconic value of that, I think, is important. And then concurrent with this, in the 50s and 60s, and it's been mentioned, Bruno mentioned it earlier, you had the work of Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew, British architects, and I think at this time it's important to note that a large part of the architects who then subsequently came to it were educated in the United Kingdom. Some went to the United States, but they largely went to the United Kingdom, although that subsequently changed. And Königsberger that Mervyn referred to, there was a sort of very strong movement, and it was recorded in the book by Fry and Drew that Bruno referred to. These are buildings actually in Lagos in Nigeria. This is by Godwin and Hopgood, an office building, and another building by Fry and Drew in Ibadan. Again, very modern statements, very similar to the images that Mark showed earlier. You know, this was a tropical tendency. It was a type of work that was going on in all parts of the Commonwealth and in tropical regions. I was fortunate to visit the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Ghana 2 years ago, which is also done by Fry and Drew. It's a really very elegant project set in a sort of parkland, and very clean, beautiful, functional, and easily maintained modern architecture. And I think these are the sort of principles that the architects of that time were keen to pursue. A sort of an architect that had a social purpose, had a social value, and also was also functional. And it's very much part of that sort of post-war functionalist tendency that took place in Britain after the war. So moving on from Fry and Drew, I'm going to talk about two architects that worked in Trinidad from the 50s onwards. First is Colin Laird, and they were both independently active after World War II, and they demonstrate two primary tendencies which informed architectural production during the period. And those influences revealed themselves through, on the one hand, this exported post-war British architectural culture, the functionalism and the interest in these climatic concerns, modified by an interest with mid-century European modernism, by Le Corbusier, and what was happening in Europe and in Germany. And on the other hand, you have the tendency that was developing in the States, which embraced the concerns and formal preoccupations that were presented by Lewis Mumford and others, which is a kind of movement that I think was in opposition to Russell Hitchcock and Philip Johnson's position. And I think Colin Laird's work is very much to do with the sort of British functionalist tendency, and Anthony Lewis's is connected to much more to do with the sort of modernist regionalist tendency. There's a nice statement by Kenneth Frampton when he refers to Colin Laird's generation, and he says, in referring to himself, Kenneth Frampton, that is, who's the same age as Colin, he said, "I see myself as a member of that generation of so-called modern architects whose concept of modernity, like that of the immediately previous generation, was already historically mediated. That is to say, unlike the pioneers of the interwar period, we didn't conceive ourselves as trying to engender an architecture. They didn't see themselves as being the avant-garde, whose form was totally unprecedented. Instead, we already saw our task as a qualified restoration of the creative vigor of the movement, which had become formally and programmatically compromised in the intervening years." So it's an interesting critical position. There's a sort of acknowledgement of the understanding of the benefit of modernism, but the feeling that it needed to be restored or corrected. And Colin, I mean, Marcos Marinas and I both interviewed Colin for Gustavo's magazine, and you know, he talked about when he was at school being completely obsessed, as everybody in his class was, with Le Corbusier, and sort of knowing all the details and all the buildings off by heart. Colin finished his studies at Regent Street Poly, and he moved to Trinidad. And I think there are two important works that is interesting to discuss that, of his. One is a written work, which was published in Caribbean Quarterly in the 50s. And as a modernist architect, as a sort of Corbusian architect, Colin made a study of Caribbean architecture that was very interesting. It was a very traditional house. And he made a very interesting study that I think is probably the first kind of critical study of traditional architecture in Trinidad. But it was an analytical study. It was a study aimed to kind of take a message out of what existed there. It's the first sort of modern critique of architecture within the region. Queen's Hall competition was won by Laird in the 50s. The original site for the project was to be in George V Park, which is where this rendering that he produced was. The brief called for a multi-purpose community centre, and the architectural landscape of Port of Spain at the time would have been characterised and dominated by the buildings of the 19th century, Victorian buildings. So I think this building would have been highly revolutionary, just running through some of his drawings that we had sort of scanned for the publication. And so you can see these are all hand-drawn, very beautiful drawings, and he still does all his drawings by hand. And then some photographs of when it was completed, and then a sort of happy school day with the children from Bishop Anstey and my mother. Anthony Lewis studied at McGill University, and then he won the Governor General's Award, and he went to study at IIT shortly after Mies arrived. And you can see Mies van der Rohe there, and there's Anthony Lewis in a smoky bar in Chicago somewhere. And he studied there. This is a sort of seminal work of Tony Lewis, is the Assumption Church in Maribor. Again, actually not that dissimilar in terms of its sort of formal typology to the Queen's Hall, but expressed in a very different way, not a functional way, in an expressive way. The church is a very clear, simple structure. It's supported by a system of systematic, robust, engineered timber trusses. It uses local material, Guyanese hardwoods, and the pink limestone facing the structural piers and the openings on the east and western flanks colours the light at the time of the morning and the evening mass to dramatic effect. It's a modern building, but it's a building that also uses kind of materials, I think, in a very sensitive way. I mean, it's a very, very beautiful building, very well, very simply put together building. This is the White House that he did, sort of a kind of overtly modern kind of building that was built at a similar time. These are the original drawings of it, and then some views of it shortly after it was completed. I'm going to talk a little bit about theories and ideas that have influenced the architecture. I think in the 70s and 80s, people got a little fed up with the functionalist architecture. And I think going back again to what Enombe was saying, there was a sort of desire or need to try and determine or define something local or regional. And you had in Guadeloupe, Jacques Berthelot, who published this book, Casa Antier, which I think is a very interesting book. And many of you might be familiar with, if you're not familiar with this, with the book Caribbean Style, which is the sort of coffee table version, I guess, of this book. But this is a sort of more kind of typological encyclopedic book in which he tried to define styles and define vernacular types and styles. And again, it's interesting, I think, because it's analytical and critical, rather than the fact that it's a necessary course or trajectory to follow, that there was a deep interest in sort of making a kind of taxonomy of all these different types and styles. And in Trinidad, John Newell Lewis, another eminent architect, produced this book, which is a very fanciful and florid kind of evocation of a kind of genotype of architecture that I don't really agree with, but it's been interesting and very well illustrated, and he analysed again the forms and the types and the influences of inflected architecture. This is a very beautiful drawing, a sketch of his, where he looks at the clerestory spaces in downtown Port of Spain, where the merchants sold their goods, and I think it's a very good, again, analysis of the typology and form that existed. So what do we do with all this, and you know, how do we kind of absorb all this information about these trends and tendencies? Well, I'm certainly interested in modern architecture. I think looking at all those sort of issues and that interest in that sort of vernacular that existed, I think, when I graduated and when I was a student, I didn't want to make architecture like that. I didn't want to make architecture that looked like architecture that existed before. I was keen to do things in a new way or in a way that kind of excited me or I thought was modern. And one of the part of the research I did, particularly when I came back to Trinidad, was to look regionally for architects that seemed to have found ways of expressing architecture that I thought was responsive and sensitive. And I'm showing these images of Paul Rudolph, of work that he did in the 50s or 60s. It was sort of concurrent with the case study movement, and I thought were really very, very beautiful when I found them, and I still do. I think they're really beautiful evocations, they're beautiful drawings, and they're modern, and yet they're also responsive and adaptive to tropical climate. And in my research, I also found out that he had been Norman Foster's professor when Norman Foster was at Yale, and having returned to Trinidad and come from Foster's office, it was very interesting to see that relationship. And a very kind of simple approach. It's like my favorite house, the Walker House, the Beach House, which is a lovely, simple house where these sort of little flaps, the shaded flaps, have these counterweights, the mold of which are beach balls, which I think is a kind of nice touch. But it's a sort of Farnsworth, Florida Farnsworth house in a way. So those are some of the sort of things, amongst others, that have interested me. And when I started practicing, you know, I wanted to start developing those ideas and using my thoughts or feelings about some of the good things I felt about the traditional architecture, but interpreting them in modern ways. These are just some sketches or studies that I did whilst doing some of the houses I did when I got back. I'm trying to understand courtyards and spaces and openness and closure and how we could use materials to kind of pull things together and yet express in a very light way. It's a house I did in Maracas St. Joseph about 10 years ago, and another one nearby. Also using form, trying to kind of get away from vernacular form, using modern forms and trying to use and work with contractors to find ways of using the techniques that they knew other than just sort of importing things wholesale. But, you know, getting people to bend corrugated galvanized iron as I'd seen them do on Glen Burkitt buildings and playing with things and kind of enjoying it and getting them built, which is another nightmare. Subsequently, I mean, I spent the last 5 years in practice with a group of architects. I left that practice again last year to go back by myself because it was getting too big and kind of commercial, and I wanted to get back to have a smaller office, which is what I have now. But this is some work that I did there where we were doing some projections for some large-scale projects in Trinidad. This is a projection of the university building. And then some office spaces, again, trying to kind of use ideas that I thought were reflective of space here or space in Trinidad, but interpret them in modern ways or in new ways or novel ways. A whole variety of spaces or types of spaces, and a little kind of, I suppose, my own little typology of types of spaces. These are all spaces used for different types of projects, you know, with lightness, transparency, openness, encouraging communication, and not to do with any sort of necessary referential vernacular elements, but just sort of open spaces. This is, I'm going to close up now a little bit over, but I won't be much longer. This is a house that I'm currently working on. It's under construction in Maribor. I wanted to talk you through it. Some really very lovely clients, and they've given me a good chance to do some interesting things. It's on a very steep site, and we kind of analyzed the site and broke it down into these sort of little zones or layers. It's very steep, the difference in level from about 10 meters to 10 meters. And the section through the house is located on the three levels. This is the entrance level, and then the house sort of steps. And what links it is, this is some images of the site in Maribor, it is, and what links it is this sort of staircase that runs the whole length of it, level to level, with this double height space at the base that looks out on the view. And then some sections through it, again trying to use materials, simple materials, and you know, not sophisticated materials, using concrete blockwork that's rendered, using working with steel fabricators locally to kind of conjure up ways of doing things, you know, using available materials and bits of steel, and I'm just making it, but trying to make a sophisticated statement and a responsive statement. These are sort of sections that run through the house from the front elevation. This is a section through the double height space. Again, it's always got this sort of double skin, the clear story on the top, the filtering of the light, and the shading of the building. Section view further up through the kitchen, and then up at the back. And what we did here was a lot of the stone that we excavated for the foundations and the substructure we then used in a gabion basket to kind of shore up the back. And I'm showing these again as not sort of, you know, models of anything anybody else should do, but just, I guess, trying to demonstrate how, you know, through the process of exploration, through the process of representation, and through the process of research, and trying to feed that research back into the building. It's, you know, that architecture is a kind of positive force. It's a force of kind of advancement, and I think that's where the sort of relevance of modernism is, in terms of this sort of commitment or this idea of the advancement of society through production, through cultural production. Voila. Thank you.